This is the current federal tax developments for the week of January the 30th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE, a division of the Lascalzo Institute, and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to have a little special session. We're going to be looking at the almost proposed regulations that were initially released by the IRS on January 18th related to the Bipartisan Budget Act's new partnership audit regime that will take effect for tax years beginning January 1st, 2018. Now, these have been long awaited because the bill that the Congress passed was honestly very short on details, many of which we need to know in order to understand how these rules are going to work, and most importantly, to allow us to help our clients modify partnership agreements, which probably need to be looked at due to this new regime. Now, this week, we're going to talk about some issues coming up. And one thing I want you to take a look at is we do have, as I've reminded you in the past couple of weeks, some updates coming up in February as we get to the very end of tax season. Wanted to remind you again, if you're in Ohio, we have four different days coming up where we're going to have a federal tax update for industry presentation on February 14th in Cincinnati, the 16th in Toledo, the 17th in Cleveland, and the 24th in Columbus and via webcast with Butch Rogers. And then I will be heading to the Portland, Oregon area in Beaverton to be putting on a business and industry tax update session on February 28th. These sessions are designed for those of you who are in industry to give you the ideas of what's been happening in taxes that may be of interest to you in your business. So if you are in that area, or you're basically that's your area of expertise, you're in private industry, you might consider looking at one of those courses and signing up for them either in Ohio or Oregon. We certainly would look forward to seeing you at either one. Well, the regulations came out, and then they didn't come out for the proposed regulations. They were initially issued as Reg 136118-15 back on the 18th of January. But the problem is, and it should be 118, I should say, of 2017, not 16, if you're looking at the slides on the screen. Always bad when the year changes. But they were issued to explain the Bipartisan Budget Act's changed the comprehensive changes to the partnership audit rules that were part of that rule, of that particular law. They were meant to replace and would replace entirely the TEFRA partnership examination routine we've all come to know over the past many years. The idea is that these will just take over. They will make it easier for the IRS to audit partnerships, and that's Congress's goal, because the idea was they're going to raise money this way. Now, they were issued on the 18th, but then this week the IRS announced that they had essentially pulled them from being published in the Federal Register. Now, that's not because the IRS had a change of heart regarding these regulations, but it was more directly related to the fact that you may remember we had a change of administrations last week. And that means that the new administration coming in, as has been true for the last two times we've had a change of administration, walks in the door and just essentially initially says, you know, put a hold on all the regulations that are in process right now. And we want to review those that took effect toward the end of my predecessor's term, because we want to make sure that somebody wasn't trying to pull a fast one on us the time before. So this is the third straight time we've had this happen. And as always tends to happen in this case, some things just become kind of collateral damage that they aren't really what was being aimed at, but they show up. Those of you that are old timers may remember the inherited IRA rules that we all thought were wonderful, that temporarily disappeared when George W. Bush came into office because they were within the time frame when he wanted to go back and look at the old regulations. Well, we're back with kind of the same thing here. But given the fact that these regs are absolutely required in order to explain a law that, to be totally frank, Congress left tons of holes in, that we have to have regulations to implement this regime because Congress left way too many things unexplained when they passed this back in November of 2015, and the fact that the IRS doesn't really have time to start over totally and rewrite from scratch since these take effect on January 1st of 2018, where we have to have those for tax years begin January 1st of 2018, Seems like probably these regs are going to be, or something very close to them, are going to be the at least the proposed regs that will be issued for discussion purposes. Now, Congress is considering a technical corrections bill in this area, and obviously some things can be added onto that, and frankly, with the proposed regulations, Congress may decide to override the IRS on some of the proposed areas just by simply legislating out, which wouldn't be a bad idea if we can actually get an explanation and, you know, and something in place. But it still seems very useful to take a look at these regulations and try to figure out what they mean. Now, the actual regulations went on for 277 pages. They're not exactly short. And today we're going to cover them, but I'm going to briefly cover them. We only got about 25 minutes to cover here. And frankly, it would take a much longer time to do a deep dive on these regulations. So what I'm going to suggest you do is we'll talk about some of the highlights here in today's session. But I also have written up, available on the website, a 64-page update that will tell you in much more detail, look at each of the regulations that were released on this, on the area of the partnership audit regime. And you can then, you know, spend time as necessary taking a look at what might be affecting your clients, because all of us are going to have some conversations with our partnership clients about whether, about how and in what way their particular partnership structure may need to be modified to take these new audit rules, which could apply to any partnership, into account. Now, one of the key things here, the basic of these new exam rules is pretty simple. The new regime defaults to assuming that we're going to audit the partnership, and then when we get our adjustments, we're going to impose a tax on the partnership, and the partnership would pay that tax. Some small partnerships will be allowed to opt out, and the regulations tell us about that too. The partnerships also, if they don't elect out or can't elect out, they can still elect to push the adjustments out to the partners, and that's called the alternative to the imputed underpayment. The TEFRA rules, as mentioned earlier, are fully repealed, so everything you know about TEFRA kind of goes away. And they are mandatory for tax years beginning after December 31st, 2017. They are optional for any exams you have for tax years that began after November 2nd, 2015, and before January 1st, 2018. So you could elect to use them. So might be important because you may want to elect to use these if your fact pattern were right. Now, some things we have here. One of the big things, and one of the few things that has generated a bit of controversy about these regulations, is the IRS's reading of the scope of the rules. This is found primarily in proposed regulations 301.6221A-1, where the IRS outlines what they mean. Now, according to the rules, this covers all line, according to the code, you know, this particular audit is going to cover all items of income, gain, loss, deduction, or credit. And the IRS defines that to mean anything that goes or should go on the 1065 or otherwise is required to be reported by the partnership under Internal Revenue Code Section 6031, even if not actually reported by the partnership on those forms. But the IRS goes a bit further in this case. The IRS also tells us that essentially, among the various things that they will review, they're going to review everything related to partnership. And in fact, in many ways, they're going to start taking things that under the TEFRA rules had been items that were decided at the partner level in a TEFRA exam. We're going to start pulling those up the partnership. One of the key ones that's mentioned by the IRS will include all penalties, and by that means including partner level penalty findings, which means that the partnership is going to have to present the case for the individual partners to potentially get out of penalties if the partnership itself can't justify it. That is, a partner could have reasonable cause even if the partnership didn't. So this is interesting because previously we had that particular discussion. Now it won't be there. Also, it makes clear things like partners' capital accounts are part of this. We also have issues looking at any other sort of transaction between a partner and a partnership, the amount of liabilities. Everything basically is on the partnership return rather than necessarily just the items of income, gain, loss, deduction, or credit. And the IRS's view should be covered. Now, the IRS determination was that Congress meant for this to be very broad, and there's no reason to believe that it should be less broad. than what we have under the TEFRA rules. Now, the IRS next goes on in Regulation 301.6221B-1 to talk about the case for partnerships that can elect out of the BBA audit regime. Now, those are small partnerships. They're defined as ones that issue fewer than 100 K-1s and that have only eligible partners, with eligible partners being limited to, effectively, partners who are individuals, C corporations, foreign entities that would be taxed as a C corporation if subject to a tax, S corporations, and estates of former partners. Now, the IRS makes it very clear that they plan to very strictly limit that option out. By that, the regulation states right up front that disregarded entities will be considered to be a type of partner that will kick you out, even if the disregarded entity drops it otherwise through to an individual. Now, they say trust. They didn't say grantor trust specifically in the regs would disqualify you, but based on how TEFRA was interpreted, they had always taken that position there. Seems to be a little reason to believe they won't take that position on this regime. There were a couple of clarifications on the 100 or fewer partner test. Number one, we do count K-1s if you have a if you have an S corporation shareholder. Let's say the S corporation issues 10 K-1s. The IRS is interpreted in counting the 100 K-1 limitation. Instead of ending up with just 10, you know, taking the one S corp K-1 out and substituting the 10 K-1s for the shareholders, you're rather going to have 11 K-1s. We're still going to count the K-1 to the S corp, but then we're going to count the other 10 on top of that, so it would be 11. Obviously, this could push you over the edge, especially if you have a number of S corp partners, because you're going to be adding one extra partner every time there's an S corp partner there, as opposed to having those shareholders hold the interest themselves. One other interesting clarification put up for eligible shareholders, the IRS, the eligible partners, I should say, the IRS did make it clear that an estate that obtains its shares after, or its interest after the death of the, you know, of the basically the decedent, that estate is going to be an ineligible shareholder because the law says the estate of a deceased shareholder, that's no longer the, or the estate of a deceased partner. The deceased person in this case, whose estate it is, never having been a partner, that estate will disqualify you. The IRS also notes very clearly, and they warn people that if you think this is going to be a way out of getting audited, the IRS is going to rattle a few sabers here. They claim that they plan to increase examinations of partnerships, both that are under the new regime and those that opt out and try to go under the pre-TEFRA rules. They also indicate they're going to be checking because they believe people might be using this as a way to dodge or evade notice. So the service, now whether they'll actually do this is a different question and how much they do, but they are making noises since a lot of people, myself included, look at these rules and think, well, the IRS loves these centralized bits so much that the odds are they won't actually examine the non-centralized one. That may still be the case, and the IRS may simply be saber rattling, but it is important to note right now that they definitely are rattling that particular saber. Another thing that has to be brought in here is we have rules for consistent treatments of items by a partner in the partnership. This is similar to what TEFRA had, except it's a bit stricter that we have. As with TEFRA, a partner is required to report consistently with the partnership unless the partner files with the IRS a notice of inconsistent treatment. The regulation makes clear that when you file that notice, you better clearly specify every item that you are being inconsistent on. The IRS makes clear in the regulations that if you don't specify every item, they're going to hold you to anything that wasn't specified in your notice of inconsistent treatment. If you take that position, what happens then is instead of you being bound to the partnership's level, the IRS rather would have to examine you personally and examine that position from your position. to see whether or not it makes sense on your return. Now, that may or may not lead to an examination of the partnership on the same issue, depending upon the reason why you have this different treatment, but you have to have it. The regulation also makes clear that if you have not filed a notice of inconsistent treatment, you can't later try to do something along those lines if an administrative adjustment request or a, you know, or basically we have an exam come down that you can't bail out at that point. You're kind of stuck with where you are when you file the return. You decide if you're going to be in or not. If we have an underpayment resulting from inconsistent treatment, then basically the IRS can just go and change the return automatically. This is considered a math error, pure and simple. There is no right to do what you can do with most math errors, which is ask the IRS to remove the math error and then get it back under the standard deficiency procedures. That's not available for this one. And the IRS effectively means they can just go straight after collecting the tax in that area. They do not have to wait for any sort of appeals period. Okay. Now, the next up, what the government did was we have an issue here dealing with the appointment of this person called a partnership representative. The partnership representative takes over for what was the tax matters partner in a TEFRA exam. And essentially, in order to be a partnership representative, we have to essentially have somebody who's appointed by the partnership. That appointment will be good until a valid resignation takes place, as described in the regulations, a valid revocation takes place, as described in regulations, or the IRS makes a termination designation is no longer in effect. The partnership representative must always update their contact information as required by forms, instructions, or other IRS guidance. To serve as a partnership representative, the individual must have a substantial presence in the United States. A substantial presence exists if the person is available to meet in person with the IRS in the United States at a reasonable time and place as is necessary and appropriate as determined by the IRS. The person also has a street address in the United States and telephone number with a US area code where the individual can be reached during normal business hours. And the person has to have a United States taxpayer identification number. If all those are true, that person can be the partnership representative. Now, if the person loses the ability to act, he no longer can serve as a partnership representative. A person loses the ability to act if any of the following occur. He dies. Well, makes some sense. They have a court order adjudicating that the person does not have the capacity to manage his or her person or estate. Number three, there is a court order enjoining the person from acting on behalf of the partnership or the entity partnership representative. The person is incarcerated, or there's a liquidation or dissolution of state law of an entity partnership representative, if you have an entity one, or any similar situation where the IRS reasonably determines a person may no longer have the capacity to act. Now, the designation is made generally by the partnership on their return. If they fail to make it, the IRS can designate. You'll probably want to avoid that. The partnership representative can resign, but only after the receipt of a notice of that there's going to be an exam or if the partnership files an administrative adjustment request. However, the law makes clear you can't file an administrative adjustment request merely to let a partnership representative resign. So the partnership representative is going to have to stick around until an audit shows up, even if the partnership representative has, let's say, retired, 5 years earlier. Oh, by the way, one of the requirements to be a partnership representative, if you name an entity as a partnership representative, you have to name who's called a designated individual who can act on behalf of the entity. And all these rules that apply to partnership representative effectively apply to this designated partnership representative that we, or this designated individual that we have to have in this case. You can also have, instead of resigning, we can have a revocation. And the partnership must submit the revocation on behalf, to the IRS saying they wish it to be revoked. Now, in order to revoke, you have to have it signed by a general partner of the partnership or a partner at the close of the year who's not a general partner if there exists no general partner who currently has capacity to act. If the entity is an LLC treated as a partnership, then a member manager is treated as a general partner for those rules and a member who is not a manager is treated as a partner other than a general partner for those rules. Now, the regulation tells us the number of things a certification must have in it, and it deals with the interesting problem. Since any general partner could revoke the status of partnership representative, the IRS says if they receive two revocation notices within 90 days that they've not essentially, you know, said were, you know, turned one down as being invalid, they're going to consider that to have revoked it. Now, when you revoke a partnership representative, you can appoint a new one. But if they get multiple revocations, none of the appointments will count. And in fact, this will be a case where the IRS will presume, or, you know, they'll move to, there's no partnership representative in place at the moment. And the theory is obviously that the IRS believes this is evidence that the partners are having a little bit of a fight among themselves. So at that point, the IRS is not going to choose, not going to say who they're going to follow. They're simply going to appoint their own partnership representative. Well, if the IRS does appoint it, we have regulations that tell us how that's going to happen. And essentially, if the partnership determines that the partnership representative, the no partnership representative designation is in effect for the year, it'll notify the partnership and the most recent representative that the designation is not in effect. And if it hasn't been due to having those two within 90 days, it will ask for a designation from the partnership. If it's those two within 90 days, the IRS goes straight to appointing. If the IRS does go to appointing, or the partnership does not designate a successor within 30 days of when the IRS notifies them, then the IRS goes to picking a representative, right? There are various issues that can trigger this. Definitely when the IRS picks a representative, they are going to take a look at some factors like the views of the partners who have a majority interest, the general knowledge of the person in tax matters and the administrative operation of the partnership, the person's access to the books and records of the partnership, and whether the person is a United States person, you know, within the meaning we talked about earlier, would be qualified to be a partnership representative. So we're going to kind of, you know, take a look at how this would go. The IRS will consider the wishes of the partnership, you know, or partners in general, as part of that consideration. Now, beyond the partnership representative, we go on. Our next move is, how do we compute how much we owe? And that's the compute, the imputed underpayment. So we move into this partnership adjustments, and this is mechanically pretty simple under the law. We compute how much adjustment there is. Let's say like we have $100,000 unreported income. That's multiplied by the highest tax rate in effect for either individuals or corporations for the partnership year. In this case today, if it happened today, it would be a 39.6% rate. So in $100,000, we would have an initial imputed underpayment of $39,600. Now, if the IRS, and the IRS would basically, you know, present the partnership with the bill. Now, the partnership may get various things. Now, some things don't result in imputed underpayments. So, you know, if we have this particular thing happening, for instance, we're just reallocating things, or we have negative adjustments, those will not go into this calculation if they are separately stated. So we'll take the regular items and the separately stated items, and some of them may end up not creating an underpayment. Those, as we'll discover, are going to have to be passed out to the partners for the reviewed years. Once we have the netted partnership adjustment, now the partnership, if it has two choices, it can decide to push the adjustments out, which we'll talk about here in just a second, or it can try to modify the adjustments. Now, the IRS does basically, in modifying the adjustments, we can do it for a number of reasons as to why we are modifying our adjustments. But what we end up doing if we have those adjustments is we can ask the IRS to push out, for various reasons, push out how much goes out. Now, some of the reasons why we can modify. We do everything except the rate-based modification first. So for instance, if a taxpayer has agreed to file amended returns and has paid the tax involved, then the adjustments related to any taxpayers who file those amended returns will be considered to be taken out of the adjustment. Now, one caveat there, this amended return has to be filed within the time period for the statute of limitations for assessments on tax for that year. If we're outside that period, the regulations, you know, strongly imply that you rather go get a closing agreement with the IRS where you agree to pay the tax and close down the year entirely. And that will, the IRS wants that almost certainly to foreclose a claim for refund coming shortly thereafter that in fact the payment can't be kept because it was, you know, it, you basically paid it outside the statute. So they want to block that. So they're going to say you have to go to a closing agreement if the statute's closed. If you can show how much of the allocation would have gone to tax-exempt partners, that comes out of your underpayment. Certain specified passive activity losses of publicly traded partnerships, that's a little more complicated thing you probably want to read into. Those could come out, as can items going to qualified investment entities, that is mutual funds and real estate investment funds. Some of those transfers will also be able to come out of the adjustment. And finally, the IRS reserves the right to add any other modification. And that includes modifications that the partnership may try to argue should be taken. You're able to plead your case with the service as to how this is going to work. After we go through all those modifications, then we now have the remaining adjustment. Now we look at any claim we've tried to make to get a lower tax rate. And that's very limited. The rule here says you can only go for a lower rate if you can show adjustments that pass to a C corp, that would be at basically 35, not 39.6, or you show adjustments that relate to capital gains or qualified dividends, and that would go to a partner who's individual or a partner who is an S corp. Now, interestingly enough, nothing in there says a partner who is a trust, even though they would qualify for a lower capital gains rate. But to the extent you can show those adjustments will reduce your rate down. The alternative to all of this, of course, is rather than having the imputed underpayment, you just go ahead and go to what's called the alternative to the imputed underpayment, or what I like to refer to as the pushout account. In the pushout accounting, what happens in that case is we end up giving to the reviewed year partners as statements on which they will compute their taxes. Now, the partnership has 45 days to decide if they want to use a pushout after the IRS gives them the final notice. And then they have 60 days from that final termination to actually get notices into the hands of all the affected partners. So that really means we kind of have 15 days if we went to the we didn't decide till the very last day if we were going to push out. Now, the statement that is given to the partners is determined. Now, these partners are the partners who were there in the reviewed year. The reviewed year is the year in which the partnership essentially was under exam. So that's the key for that one. So that's going to be the issue. Now, those partners receive statements, and those statements also contain a safe harbor computation of tax. So that safe harbor computation of tax, they can agree to either pay the safe harbor computation of tax, or they can go back and recompute the tax. Now, they have to recompute for the year of the reviewed year, and they have to recompute for every intervening year that would have affected their return and add up the taxes for all that. The alternative, the safe harbor, is going to be taking their share of the adjustment and multiplying it by 39.6%. No modifications are going to be allowed in the safe harbor amount. There'll also be a safe harbor interest amount. Same basic issue there. The regulations also describe how a partnership gets an administrative adjustment request. And that uses something very similar to what we have here for the exams themselves. If an imputed underpayment exists after the AAR is done, the partnership can choose to pay the imputed underpayment. And there you would make your own adjustments and you have to include the check, but you don't need IRS permission for adjustments anymore. Or you could elect to push it out to, again, the reviewed year's partners. If there's no underpayment, you must push it out to the reviewed year's partners. There is no choice in that situation. Now, there also are a number of special rules I want to discuss. We're going to go a little over time today, so I'll warn you ahead of time. But the special rules that we find first, under Regulation 301-6241-2, we have special rules that deal with bankruptcy cases. And what it tells us basically is if a partnership files a Chapter 11 proceeding, the statute of limitations will stop running during the pendency of that proceeding. So filing Chapter 11, we stop everything and we don't pick up again until the Chapter 11 proceedings concluded. The IRS also issued regulations that have the somewhat deceptive name of partnership ceases to exist at 301-6241-3. What these really are the backstop to make sure the partnership get the adjustment, the imputed underpayment gets paid. Because, you know, you could very well just have a, you know, a partnership that simply was, you know, broke, an LLC that had no assets. Well, yeah, we'll pay the imputed underpayment. We have no assets to pay it. Well, the IRS, if the IRS determines a partnership ceases to exist, then they're going to collect the tax or whatever the unpaid part is from the adjustment year partners. Now, first, let's think about that. Adjustment year partners are those who are partners in the year the exam ends. Because, by the way, on the push-out adjustment, that's also the year in which we take our adjustments into account, is the year in which the exam ends. So that means, though, it's a different set of partners than had we elected to push the adjustment out. So if you have a partnership that is going to be deemed ceased to exist, a push-out election will get it to the reviewed year's partners. If you don't push out, it's going to end up going to the adjustment year partners. Now, a partnership ceases to exist if the partnership has formally terminated, not just tech term, but as a formal, as totally terminated prior to the date when the audit goes final, or the IRS determines the partnership can't pay the full imputed amount. If the full imputed adjustment can't be paid, then it's going to push that out to those people who are partners in the adjustment year. The IRS also ruled, because this has come up under TEFRA before, what if the IRS was arguing somebody's trying to get some benefit by using a partnership structure and the IRS argues they weren't really partners? Well, under these rules, the IRS says if you file a 1065, the Bipartisan Budget Act regime, all that stuff, will apply to you even if we decide you're not a partnership. So there'll still be the same rules for paying everything at the entity level. And they also go on to say, even if it's determined there was no entity, so the entity's invalid, still we're going to apply these rules to the whatever that kind of grouping or vague association of people who weren't partners because they weren't in the entity, we're still going to apply the BBA rules to that group. Now, this has been a very rapid summary of what's going on in these rules. So I do strongly suggest you take a look at the rules and you can go ahead and download the write-up I've got, about 62 pages. It'll take a little while to get through, but you're going to need to be talking to your partnership clients about the changes we probably need to make their partnership agreements, because as you probably noticed going through this, and I've just brushed over it, there are a lot of decisions that are going to have to be made during a partnership examination that falls under these rules that we are not making today. And we're going to probably need to have some good guidance in the partnership agreement to try to help us understand how to deal with that. That's simply the way it works. Well, it's winter time now, and it's kind of nice to be sitting in front of the fire, getting cozy, but unfortunately, we're in tax season. So you want to rely on your state society to help you keep up during these coming tax season months. State societies are great sources of updates, including this one, I hopefully you find useful. And they're going to be a great source of updates when tax season ends as we get together and discuss what's changed, because we may have various changes while we're all stuck trying to do tax returns. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January 30th, 2017. Be sure to catch our updates posted during the week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. This week, I should get to actually start writing some. I didn't get many up this past week because, hey, I spent all that time trying to go through the nearly 300 pages of documents that were these proposed regs. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, where I'll be found at edzollers. With that, hopefully you'll have a good week here as we get into our final week of January and start entering the month of February. Yes, we're actually 1 month through 2017 already. And I hope to see you back next week, as we'll talk about additional developments here in the area of federal taxes.